Please join me in going to the 21st chapter of Acts. We will finish this chapter today. Quite a few verses that we want to continue on through our journey through the book of Acts. Acts chapter 21. You know, sometimes we use the short two-word phrase, if only. We say that with what could have been. We say that with what might have been. All of us have the if-onlys in life. Have you ever given into that kind of thinking? If only. There's the if-onlys that stem from having done wrong. If only I had listened to my parents. If only I had read my Bible first. If only I had never married or dated that person. If only I had biblically disciplined my child. If only. They're endless, aren't they? All of us have those if onlys. I appreciated the message by Brother Mike Schrock about how that we are to forget those things which are behind and press forth unto those things which are before. And yet those if onlys seem to always be the trailer that we pull through life. Because the consequences still show up from day to day. So when Paul said, forgetting those things which are behind, it's not like you can erase your memory. It is, as he preached, we don't let those things drag us down. But there's also if-onlys that stem from having done right. It may include thoughts like this. If only I had known. Or if only I had been there. If only I had pursued that occupation. It's not like, well, there was a right and a wrong there. It's just, you know, why did I pursue that? Look at all the trouble I'm in today. Look at the difficulty of this job. Or if only I had not gone to that doctor. If only I had gone to that doctor. If only I had not had that surgery. If only he, she had not boarded that plane. Again, life is full of if-onlys. And if we let that consume us, we are stuck in the past. When you look at the overall scene of Acts chapter 21, it begins with warnings to Paul, don't go to Jerusalem. He goes anyway. And when you read those warnings, for example, you go to verse 4, this is review because we've already preached through this passage, but there are some disciples there in Tyre who through the Spirit say that he should not go to Jerusalem. And then again in verse 12, when we heard these things, both we and they of that place, in other words, his whole team, which includes Trophimus, Tychicus, and Sopater, and so forth and so on. They're all mentioned in chapter 20, verse 4. They are all there, and they besought him not to go up to Jerusalem. You know what happens when he goes to Jerusalem. That's what we're going to look at today. And we're caused to think, if only Paul had listened to these people. Because it's in Jerusalem that he runs into trouble. And as I was reading this passage this week and studying this passage, not just this week, but the week before, I got to thinking the same thing. What if Paul had not gone to Jerusalem? And then it led to three other if-onlys that I see in the passage. And yet Paul never sank into that kind of thinking. Here's the kind of thinking the Apostle Paul had. Turn with me to Philippians chapter 1. This is very instructive. In Philippians chapter 1, we read this in verse 12 and following. By the way, he writes this epistle from prison. Philippians 1:12, but I would you should understand, brethren, that the things which have happened unto me have fallen out rather unto the furtherance of the gospel, so that my bonds in Christ are manifest in all the palace and in all other places. And many of the brethren in the Lord, waxing confident by my bonds, are much more bold to speak the word without fear. Some indeed preach Christ even of envy and strife, and some also of goodwill. The one preach Christ of contention, not sincerely, supposing to add affliction to my bonds, but the other of love, knowing that I am set for the defense of the gospel. What then? Notwithstanding every way, whether in pretense or in truth, Christ is preached. And I therein do rejoice, yea, and will rejoice. For I know that this shall turn to my salvation. He's not talking about his soul's salvation. He's talking about deliverance, perhaps physically, through your prayer and the supply of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, according to my earnest expectation and my hope, that in nothing I shall be ashamed, but that with all boldness, as always, so now also in Christ, shall be magnified in my body, whether it be by life or by death. For to me live, to live is Christ, and to die is gain. You don't see Paul giving in to the if only here, do you? This passage in Acts chapter 21, what we're going to look at today, verses 27 to 40, is the commencement or the beginning of Paul's incarcerations. It's the beginning of the time when he is in and out of prison. Out of all the things that Paul did to upset the Jews wherever he went because he preached Christ, out of all those things, it commenced with one small, seemingly insignificant act that we're going to see here in Acts chapter 21. So as you read the rest of the book of Acts, and Paul's in and out of prison, he's shipwrecked, and all the negative things that happen, it really starts with this one thing that we're going to read in the book of Acts, in a particular verse in this chapter. By the way, this is the Acts of the Apostles. And here's one act that we could say, if only this hadn't happened. And it's not a bad act. In fact, it's a good act. It's a good action. And this one verse sets the scene for the rest of the book of Acts. It establishes a change in Paul's ministry. He is no longer able to travel on these missionary journeys. He is now only in and out of prison, and mostly in prison. You would think it was insignificant. In fact, the King James Version puts it in parentheses. It's just kind of an afterthought. You're saying, why don't you get to the verse so we can find it? Because I'm trying to set it up. Look at verse 29. The Jews had seen before with Paul in the city Trophimus, an Ephesian, whom they supposed that Paul had brought into the temple. That one thing right there. As you go on into the book of Acts, as you see him standing before Festus and Felix and King Agrippa, they're always going back to this one thing. The Jews happened to see him in the city with the Gentile, and they supposed he brought that same Gentile into the temple where Gentiles could not go. They supposed it. They hadn't witnessed it. They supposed it. And based upon that one thing, the rest of the book of Acts, in fact, that's the rest of Paul's life. And it all started because he went to Jerusalem. If only he hadn't gone. This is his fifth visit to Jerusalem since his conversion. He's been there four other times. This is the time of Pentecost in the year 56, as far as we can tell. By the way, I'm going according to the timeline of the travels and writings of Paul the Apostle by Leighton Talbert. And when you look at the long view from Acts chapter 21, we know that Paul would be executed during his second Roman imprisonment right around the year 67, 11 years later. So this is the beginning of the end of Paul's life, albeit 11 years. That's the long view, but intermediately, in Acts 21, this chapter, again, this is the year 56 when he's seized by these Asiatic Jews. He's saved by the Roman military. We're going to look at that. In Acts chapter 23, in the years 56 to 59, he's imprisoned in Caesarea. In Acts chapter 27, the year approximately 59, he's on his voyage to Rome. An interesting chapter where they are shipwrecked, and it's due to Paul's advice, not taken that they're shipwrecked, it's due to Paul's advice that they listen to that they're saved. And then Acts chapter 28, the last chapter of Acts, takes us from 59, really to 62 or thereabouts, but I'm just going to say till 8 to 67, he's in and out of Roman prisons, in and out of Roman prisons. But there he writes Ephesians, Colossians, Philemon, Philippians, what we call the prison epistles. He also writes three pastoral epistles, 1st and 2nd Timothy and Titus. So today I'm going to do something that I don't typically do. I'm just going to go through it verse by verse, and as I go through these verses, I'm going to make comments on these verses until I get to something that I want you to see. So let's start with verse 26. We left with this verse 2 weeks ago. In verse 26 of chapter 21 of Acts, we read this. Then Paul took the men, then and the next day, purifying himself with them, entered into the temple to signify the accomplishment of the days of purification until that an offering should be offered for every one of them. Verse 27. And when the 7 days were almost ended, the Jews which were of Asia, when they saw him in the temple, stirred up all the people and laid hands on him. Notice the words almost ended. The plan of James and the elders that you find in verse 18 seemed to work. Almost. There are in the temple from as far away as Asia, probably the city of Ephesus, who are also in the temple, and they recognized Paul, who was infamous to them. And so they did what these Asiatic Jews did best. They get the crowd riled up and confused about this guy they literally hate. Verse 28, crying out, "Men of Israel, help! This is the man that teacheth all men everywhere against the people and the law and this place, and further brought Greeks also into the temple and hath polluted this holy place." I want you to see in that verse the impact of Paul's teaching. He keeps on teaching. It's in the continuous present tense. And he teaches all men everywhere, which is what we should be doing. These men who are calling out against the Apostle Paul in verse 28 are talking about how he brought these men into this holy place. You know, it's interesting how that sometimes it's easier to claim to defend a holy place than to be a holy person. I think I see people who defend things that they think are holy, and they are. They'll say, that shouldn't be happening in the sanctuary at church. Kids, you shouldn't be running around, and I agree. And they're fast to defend something that's taking place in a sanctuary, which is a holy place. And yet in their own life, are they holy? Maybe so, but many times not. These men are wicked, and yet they're determined to defend this holy place. Verse 29. Now we get to that one verse that's kind of central to the rest of the book of Acts, where they had seen before with him in the city Trophimus, an Ephesian, whom they supposed that Paul had brought into the temple. These are no doubt Jews from the Asian city of Ephesus. Do you remember what happened in Ephesus? You go back to chapter 19 and there is a riot. There is a riot in Ephesus. And these Jews who were against Paul back then are now in Jerusalem for Pentecost. They see him in the temple. and they had seen him earlier that week or earlier walking through the city with an Ephesian by the name of Trophimus. You see, Paul had done what they would never do, walk down the street with a Gentile. It was serious for a non-Jew to enter the temple past the court of the Gentiles. And that's what they supposed Paul had done, that he had brought his friend Trophimus into the temple. A Gentile is never to go into the temple beyond the court of the Gentiles. In 1871, and again in 1935, they discovered in Jerusalem two notices written in Greek and Latin, warning that death was the penalty for anyone who went beyond a certain place in the temple. Two of these notices, both in Greek, were found in 1871 and again in 1935, and here's what it read. No foreigner may enter within the barricade which surrounds the temple and enclosure. Anyone who is caught doing so will have himself to blame for his ensuing death. I could not have gone in there. Most of you could not have gone in there. Death was the result. And the Romans had granted the Jews, the religious leaders, the authority to deal with anyone who broke this law, including the right of execution. Just go ahead and execute somebody. They were given that right because the Romans knew the jealousy that the Jews had for the temple. So these Asiatic Jews think that just because they kept on seeing Trophimus with Paul in the city, it must also be true that he had led Trophimus into the temple. This is a supposition. And it's the whole basis that follows for all that follows against Paul. A man once called this the logic of prejudice. He put it this way. Number one, wherever Paul went, his Gentile friends went. Number two, Paul was seen in the temple, therefore his friends must have been in the temple with him. Paul was seen in the temple. Therefore Trophimus must have gone in there with him. But the key word, folks, is supposed. The logic of prejudice permeates our society. Did you know that all white people are evil? It's the logic of prejudice. Did you know that all policemen are racist? Did you know that Judeo-Christian civilization is systematically racist and evil? It's that logic of prejudice. Verse 30. And all the city was moved, and the people ran together, and they took Paul, literally, they took hold of him and drew him, literally dragged him out of the temple, and forthwith the doors were shut. The word there implies the doors were slammed behind him. The whole city, verse 31, and as they went about to kill him, tidings came unto the chief captain of the band that all Jerusalem was in an uproar. They can't prove anything, so they try to kill him before a trial would take place. They're not interested in justice. They're interested in prejudice. You'll notice the words chief captain here. That's literally the word kiliarch, which has to do with a commander of 1,000 men. We find his name later in Acts is Claudius Lysias. You can jump to chapter 23, verse 26 and see it there again. Chapter 24, verse 7. Chapter 24, verse 22. Claudius Lysias is the kiliarch, the commander. And these Roman soldiers are stationed in the fortress of Antonia. They went about to kill him. Jerusalem was in an uproar. Verse 32. This chief captain immediately took soldiers and centurions and ran down unto them. And when they saw the chief captain and the soldiers, they left beating of Paul. At least, folks, since centurions is in the plural, at least 200 men come out of the tower or the fortress of Antonia, which is right there in the northwest part of the temple itself. Two sets of stairs coming down from there into the temple, and these soldiers are there in a heartbeat. They ran down because they see what's taking place. The captain, or this Kiliarch, only knows that the city is in an uproar. And he is naturally given the impression that Paul is the one who is at fault. Verse 32, which we just read. When the rioters saw the captain and the soldiers literally running down upon them, they stopped beating Paul. Verse 33. Then the chief captain came near and took him and commanded him to be bound with two chains. He's assuming that Paul's guilty. He's the one who incited this crowd and demanded who he was and what he had done. It's easy to presume that Paul is the guilty one rather than innocent, because a large, angry crowd is presumed to be right. And yet, as Carver in his commentary says, a mob never knows what it is doing, nor why. Does that make you think of anything happening today? Columbia University, Harvard, University of Texas, all over this country, people are rioting. And yet it's interesting to watch people go up and put a microphone in their face and say, "Why are you doing this?" "I don't know. Everybody else is doing it." Maybe a few people can somehow explain why they're doing this. But then when you start asking them questions about Israel, they can't give you a good answer. They just know that they hate Jews. It's telling, folks, when a Roman soldier is more interested in justice than those Jews who profess to be God's people in this passage. Isn't that interesting? Verse 34. And some, this is after the chief captain demands, what's taking place here? Some cried one thing, some another among the multitude. And when he could not know the certainty for the tumult, he commanded him to be carried into the castle. The word castle is where we have the word, the fort. That's the fortress of Antonia. The Kiliarch had a hard time discerning what happened. Verses 35 and 36. And when he came upon the stairs, so it was that he, Paul, was borne of the soldiers for the violence of the people, for the multitude of the people followed after, crying, "Away with him." The intimidation by the crowd continues. "Away with him." Same thing, by the way, said of Jesus in Luke 23:18 and John 19:15. "Away with him." Verse 37. And as Paul was led into the castle, that is into the fortress of Antonia, he said unto the chief captain, "May I speak unto thee? May I speak unto thee?" Paul asks to speak to the Kiliarch. He's not presumptuous. He asks permission. And then he is very humble and polite in how he asks. And notice what the Kiliarch says. "Canst thou speak Greek?" I wish I could speak Greek. I can read it somewhat. Wish I could speak it. "Canst thou speak Greek?" Folks, understand something. Somebody who spoke Greek as well as the Apostle Paul did, when he is confused with someone else, an Egyptian, and he can speak Greek? Really? This is an educated man. And the Kiliarch is surprised. Because the Kiliarch, who is probably, when you look at his name, Claudius Lysias, who is probably a Greek by birth, can't believe this man knows Greek. Verse 38, "Art not thou that Egyptian, which before these days madest an uproar and leddest out into the wilderness 4,000 men that were murderers? Aren't you that Egyptian?" He is assuming that Paul is guilty, and he thought he had just apprehended a most wanted man. You see, this Egyptian got away. You read the history that Josephus gives, and there was an Egyptian who took a whole army of followers, they say 30,000, and he had promised them, when we get to Jerusalem and we're at the Mount of Olives, we're going to march and the walls of the city are going to fall down and we're going to go in and we're going to take the city from the Romans. Well, it fell apart. Luke here mentions there's 4,000 of them, and that's because it was 4,000 of those 30,000 who had some certain ability that we're going to see here. He led this Egyptian, murderers. So he assumed that Paul is that Egyptian. Literally, the word murderers is dagger men. Dagger men. Dagger men mingled with crowds at festivals and the like with daggers hidden beneath their cloaks and stabbed their opponents by stealth. So these dagger men would be in the crowds, and they had daggers. They didn't have those x-ray machines. There's no TSA there to see what you've got on you. And these men, probably around 4,000 of them, are there in all the festivals and all the feasts, and they're mingling within the crowd. And if they had somebody they wanted to kill, they were very successful in doing it. And they assume Paul is the one who led them. Boy, isn't it interesting how that a crowd that is so wicked can look at one man and accuse him of things that there's no way he did that. I mean, I can see your minds racing right now. You're thinking of our former president. But we're talking about a Christian man here. The Apostle Paul. Verse 39. But Paul said, I am a man which am a Jew of Tarsus, a city in Cilicia, a citizen of no mean or no insignificant city. And I beseech thee, suffer me or allow me, please give me the permission to speak unto the people. Here the Apostle Paul uses his Roman citizenship to testify to the crowd. By the way, folks, you have all kinds of privileges living here in America right now. Paul grants us a tremendous example of somebody who uses his citizenship, the freedom that he has to speak, and he has granted it, much as you still have the freedom of speech. He asks to speak to the crowd. Verse 40. And when he had given him license, that is, Claudius Lysias gave him permission, Paul stood on the stairs. Remember the two flights of stairs that lead into the Tower of Antonia? And he stands on those stairs and beckoned with the hand unto the people. And when there was made a great silence, he spake unto them in the Hebrew tongue, saying, well, I'm kind of interested to hear what he says. But that's next time. Because now you've got a chapter break. What did he say? What is he doing here? And we know that from this verse that Paul also spoke Hebrew. Somebody once said that the Apostle Paul could speak fluently five languages. We know from this passage he speaks Greek, right? We also know he speaks Hebrew, possibly Aramaic, Latin, and some other languages. And these stairs on the tower, on the fortress of Antonia, become his pulpit. Now, you knowing this, what's taking place, isn't it tempting to say, if only Paul had, and you fill in the blank. And I want you in the rest of this time that we have is to see these four things. If only Paul. And the first thing I want you to see is it's tempting to say if only Paul regarding his purpose. You see, he got into trouble because he purposed to go to Jerusalem. And we would be tempted to say if only Paul had not gone to Jerusalem. If only he had not gone there. And yet he believed it to be the will of God, and so he purposed to do it. Only months earlier, when he wrote the book of Romans, he had expressed some apprehension about going to Jerusalem. Let me read you those verses. Here's what he said to the Romans in the book of Romans chapter 15. "Now I beseech you, brethren, for the Lord Jesus Christ's sake and for the love of the Spirit, that ye strive together with me in your prayers to God for me." Please pray for me. Please pray for me. Verse 31 of that chapter. "That I may be delivered from them that do not believe in Judea, and that my service which I have for Jerusalem may be accepted of the saints." He knew that what would happen to him in Jerusalem would not be positive, it would be negative. He knew that as far back as when he wrote the book of Romans. He knew that back in this chapter when he met those disciples in Tyre. He knew it when he met those other disciples in Caesarea. "Paul, don't go to Jerusalem, don't go." And we can look back and we can say, "If only you hadn't gone. Paul, if only you had listened to people." Number two, it's tempting to say, "if only," regarding Paul's counselors. You see, he got into trouble as well because he listened to some church leaders. Who's the pastor in Jerusalem? Do you remember? James. James and the elders are the ones who came up with this great idea that they say in verse 23, "Do therefore this that we say to thee, we have four men which have a vow, take them and go into the temple." If only Paul had not listened to James and the elders. How many times have you said, "If only I hadn't listened to that counselor. If only I hadn't listened to mom and dad as they counseled me. If only this," and we just go on with these if onlys. By the way, in hindsight, you can say that he should not have listened to James and elders, but he should have listened to the disciples who said not to go to Jerusalem. How are you going to choose? Thirdly, it's tempting to say if only regarding Paul's associations, and this is the big one, because he got into trouble because of association with a Gentile. "Paul, if only you hadn't been hanging around Trophimus. Paul, if only when you went through the streets of Jerusalem, you'd have been like every other Jew and you would have not hung around a Gentile." But folks, Trophimus is a Christian. And that wall of separation in Jesus Christ has broken that wall down. He's going to hang around Gentile Christians because they're Christians. You know, sometimes we do get into trouble because we associate with the wrong crowd. Anybody here ever gotten into trouble because you were hanging around the wrong people? Anybody? Don't raise your hand. I'll raise mine. I think it happens to all of us. When I was a kid, I would hang around kids, most notably my brothers. And we'd go ringing running. You know what that is? And I got into trouble. Because you feel pressured by your friends, associations. Folks, listen to me, especially you young people. You watch out who you hang around. You show me your friends, you show me your associates, and I can tell you somewhat what's going to happen in your life. Because they will have an influence on you. You know, there's a verse in 1 Corinthians that says this: "Be not deceived, evil communications corrupt good manners." You know what that literally means? Be not deceived, bad company corrupts morals. Bad company. I find this wise advice from the wisest man who ever lived outside of Jesus Christ. And he said this, he that walketh with wise men shall be wise, but a companion of fools shall be destroyed. Now we're looking at the young people here today, but folks, the same thing happens with older people. You can still hang around the wrong people. You can still associate yourself with the wrong kind of people. And we would say, if only Paul had not been with Trophimus. But hey, here's a good association. These Jewish antagonists would say, no, it's because you hung around this Gentile. But that's not wrong for a Christian, to hang around somebody who is also a Christian living for the Lord. In fact, the psalmist put it this way in Psalm 119, verse 63. I am a companion of all them that fear thee, of them that keep thy precepts. Those are my companions. Just because somebody attends Westside Baptist Church doesn't mean that you can be a true companion with them. Is he or she one who keeps his precepts? That word companion, I am a companion of all them that fear thee, literally means I am joined, I am coupled with all those who fear thee. And the same word is used for Daniel. Children, young people, can anyone tell me who Daniel's three friends were? All right, any adults? Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Did you know that they are called in Daniel chapter 2 and verse 18 his fellows? It's the word companions. Those he was joined together with. Remember when Daniel was getting, when he was confronted with interpreting the king's dream there in Daniel chapter 2? And he went to his three companions, those men he was joined together with, and he said, man, we need to pray. You see, Daniel was a companion with all them that fear thee, of all them that keep thy precepts. And he was able, with those three friends, Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, known as Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, he was able to find God's will because those three friends helped him. We also have the example of a man where that same word companionship is used, but it's translated this way, joined. King Jehoshaphat. Good or bad king? Good. You know why I'm doing this with my hand, kind of going, good? It's because the prophet came to him and said, you have joined, literally, you have become a companion with Ahaziah, the son of Ahab. You have joined yourself with him. And it was through his association that at the end of his life, a really good king did a really stupid thing. He associated himself with another wicked king. It's tempting to say if only regarding Paul's associations, but in this case, he was a good friend. In fact, he's probably the one who led Trophimus to the Lord. And Trophimus didn't just say, well, I got saved and just lived his life the way. No, Trophimus was a dedicated man. And then here's the last thing. It's tempting to say if only regarding Paul's words. Let me just say this. Have you ever said something and said, oh, if I could only go back and take that back? Or have you ever had the opportunity to witness to somebody and after you're done, oh, I should have said, if only I had said. All of us do that. Well, Paul's words get him into trouble in chapter 22. Because these people are completely silent. And it's amazing how this crowd, after the apostle Paul goes to the Kiliarch, Claudius Lysias, and says, would you allow me to speak to the people? And there he is on top of those stairs, and he is beckoning with his hands, and perhaps the Kiliarch and the soldiers are pointing out to him. I don't know. Be quiet. He's got something to say. And Paul begins to speak in the Hebrew dialect. Now look at the first verse of chapter 22. He says, men, brethren, and fathers, hear ye my defense, which I now make unto you. So he's now speaking. And it says in verse 2, this is why they became even more quiet. And when they heard that he spake in the Hebrew tongue to them, they kept the more silence. And this crowd, this huge crowd, is very quiet. Until he says one word. You'll find that word in chapter 22. And in fact, in verse 22, it says, and they gave him audience unto this word. What was that word? Go back to the previous verse. Paul is giving his testimony, and here's what he says. Jesus said to me, he is Jesus. He said to me, depart, for I will send thee far hence unto the, what's the bad word? Boom! And then they erupted. If only Paul had left that out of his testimony. If only Paul had not gone to Jerusalem, if only Paul had not associated with Trophimus, if only Paul hadn't listened to those counselors, if only Paul had watched his words, we perhaps would not be reading the rest of what we read in the book of Acts. Shipwreck, trials. But neither would you read a book like Philippians, written from a Roman prison. Neither would you read, perhaps, the book of Ephesians and Philippians, Colossians, Philemon, written from a Roman prison. The Kiliarch, we find out, never was able to determine why the people were going to kill Paul. He was never able to get it. You'll find that in chapter 23. It's almost in frustration that he writes a letter to the Roman governor. He says, I tried, I could not find out. I'm sending him to you. He just knew that the whole city was against him. And folks, we always know that when the whole city, when most of the crowd is against somebody, that crowd is right, correct? You just shook your head no at the concept of democracy. Haven't you heard in our country that we need to defend democracy? How many have heard that? What a lie. Remember, what our founders founded in this country is not a democracy. It is a constitutional republic. Our founders feared that the day like this would come, when it's when the majority of the people speak, when we have mob rule. And yet that's what's happening in our nation. And I'm not trying to get off on politics here. I am making a point here. Persecution may increase in America because the majority of the people in this nation do not like what you say and do not like what you do as a Christian. And as you do right, and the negative things happen to you like they happened to the Apostle Paul, you're going to be tempted to say, if only I had not listen to my pastor. If only I had not gone to Jerusalem or to that city. If only I had not been hanging around that other Christian who's living for the Lord. If only I had not said what I said in witnessing to that person. If only. Let me say something. If comfort is your goal, if lack of persecution is your goal, you're going to say this: if only I had given in. If only I hadn't been such a committed Christian. If only I had compromised. The Bible says this of someone else who said if. It was Jesus himself. Here's what he said. He said, if I had not come and spoken unto them, they had not had sin. If I had not done among them the works which none other men did, They had not had sin. And we could say this, Jesus, if only you had not said anything, and if only you hadn't healed people on the Sabbath, Lord, if you hadn't said anything, you would have never been crucified. Are we better than he? For us to say, oh, if only I just hadn't lived as a Christian. If only I hadn't taken that firm stand, I would have never got myself into this mess with the world. Folks, do away with the if-onlys. And just realize that if you're doing the right thing scripturally, if you're hanging around the right people, if you're following God's will and going to the cities you go to, if you're following the Lord's will in the words that you speak, just say, you know, all this has fallen out rather unto the furtherance of the gospel. It doesn't look like it right now, but it will. For his glory.